Welcome to today's program titled Trends, Challenges, and Best Practices for Lab Compliance Program. At this time, all participants are in listen-only mode. For those of you who are logged into the web presentation, you are encouraged to submit questions throughout the conference by selecting the chat pod located in the lower left corner of your screen. Then type and send your question that way. I would now like to introduce our host for today's call. David Gee is a partner at the law firm of Davis, Wright, Tremaine in the firm's Seattle and Los Angeles offices. David has over two decades of experiences representing clinical laboratories, with several years of experience working as an in-house attorney for two of the nation's largest clinical lab companies. David brings both a legal and business perspective to his practice. Dana Simons is the Chief Compliance and Privacy Officer of Acumen. Acumen partners with health systems to improve the quality of patient outcomes by driving laboratory excellence. With over 20 years of experience in laboratory compliance, Dana has a wealth of knowledge and practical skills for navigating the challenging issues presented in the laboratory industry. Kristen Blanchette is an associate at the law firm of Davis, Wright, Tremaine in the firm's Los Angeles office. Kristen is also a certified professional compliance officer and has experience representing healthcare providers on both the East and West Coast. Kristen is part of the laboratory team at Davis, Wright, Tremaine. David, you may now begin.
All right, that was me messing with the slides. I apologize. I'd like to welcome all of you today and express our appreciation for having the opportunity to share some information with you this morning. As most of you are aware, clinical laboratories have been in the spotlight in previous decades, in the early 1990s, when several of the large laboratories in the country were accused of billing for millions of unnecessary tests and eventually ended up settling over the course of the decade for $823 million, which was real money back then. And we've seen some time go by where there has been maybe less focus and less activity in the area of enforcement against clinical laboratory companies, but I would say that in the past year and a half or so, we've seen an increase in focus on the activities of clinical laboratory companies, both with some attention in the media through the Wall Street Journal and Forbes, as well as a couple of fairly high-profile settlements that were announced earlier this month. If you take a look at the top here, there's a chart, and then also at the end of the slides, I think there's a handout that lists some of the settlements that have taken place this year. I think it's also notable that in 2014, the OIG or the Department of Health and Human Services reported that they recovered nearly $5 billion in fiscal year 2014 through their investigations and audits. And the reason that this is notable is, of course, that it gives us an opportunity to maybe get back on alert and make sure that we're, as compliance professionals, that we're focused on the risks and addressing the risks that have drawn the attention of the government and putting in place effective compliance measures so that we can avoid that same kind of problems. Just a quick note on the three settlements that have made the news, the three enforcement actions that we've highlighted on this first slide. The HDL settlement, which was just announced a little over a week ago, involve processing and handling fees. I think the reason that this one is notable is that there were a number of different activities involved, and we'll talk a little bit more about the genesis, I think, of some of the activities involved. But the fact is that this is something that was also highlighted in the 2014 fraud alert, this practice and that of paying doctors for patient registries. And so this has clearly been on the minds of the federal regulators. The Biodiagnostic Laboratory Services settlement is also one that is worth watching because it reminds compliance professionals in the laboratory world of the importance of paying attention to state law. In that case, a state, that is New Jersey's Clinical Laboratory Act, has a specific prohibition on certain types of payments and arrangements, and the consequence of the violation of that law has resulted in the guilty pleas by 38 individuals and 26 physicians. It's actually kind of good news for the lab folks because over the years we've had a constant refrain from the sales and rep and others folks in the labs complaining that only the laboratories ever get into trouble, but in fact this is an example of how physicians too share some of the pain for non-compliance. The last is an example of how competitors have tried to keep each other within the compliance guidelines, and lawsuits have been brought against, in this case, Ameritox against Millennium, and in this case, there is not just a confirmation of certain requirements regarding the provision of supplies and so forth that we'll talk about a bit later, but also it's a case where the government has also joined in the appeal process by filing an amicus brief. So another opportunity for the government to share with us its views on the provision of free supplies and equipment. So listen up. We've got some good things to talk about. We're going to go ahead and have Kristen share with us a little bit of information about compliance programs.
Thanks, David, and welcome, everyone. I just want to highlight that compliance programs really are not only essential to limit and avoid the kinds of risks that are making the news, as David mentioned in the previous slide, but they're required by the law. Just by way of background, the concept of compliance programs began in 1998 when the Office of Inspector General issued guidance to laboratories. Just a note, we've included this guidance as part of our handouts for your reference. Since that time, since 1998, the OIG has issued guidance to other providers like hospitals and small physician groups, durable medical equipment suppliers, but it's notable that the labs were the first on the list. At that time, the guidance was instructive, but not mandatory. It wasn't until 2005, about 7 years later, that compliance programs became mandatory for entities receiving Medicaid funds. You can find this mandate in the Deficit Reduction Act of 2005. Specifically, it requires all entities receiving at least $5 million in annual Medicaid payments to have compliance programs. In 2010, with the enactment of the Affordable Care Act, compliance programs became mandatory for all Medicare-enrolled providers. Just a note on the fourth bullet, we do expect the department will at some point, at some date, issue proposed regulations with regard to compliance programs. That they indicated that in 2011. Now it's 4 years later, and we still have no proposed regulations, which really isn't surprising considering the backlog with the process for proposing regulations. But we just want to highlight that as that is something that we can expect to see in the future. One final note about compliance programs. They're really an essential part if a lab intends on pursuing business opportunities. Lately, in our practice, we've seen investors and potential buyers in mergers and acquisitions request that labs provide all documents related to compliance programs. this really has become a routine and necessary process of the due diligence process. So one tip is that labs that really are seeking potential business opportunities will want to make sure they have their compliance program timeline, all their compliance documents really readily available to demonstrate that this is a main focus of their operations. So before we dive into the actual seven core elements of the compliance program, we just really want the next two slides outline some of the laws and resources that should be incorporated in your program. The next two slides are useful for any type of laboratory, from startups to large laboratories with existing compliance programs that are already established. Just to quickly, briefly review some of the key laws on this slide, the anti-kickback statute, as many of you are probably aware of, is an intent-based statute, which prohibits the offering, paying, soliciting, or receiving anything of value to induce federal healthcare program business. There are specific safe harbors for the anti-kickback statute. The other very common statute is the Stark Law, the self-referral law, which prohibits a physician from referring Medicare and Medicaid patients for designated health services, which include the laboratory testing, to an entity with which the physician or an immediate family member has a financial relationship. Now, in contrast to the anti-kickback statute, this is a strict liability statute, which means that you do not need to prove intent. A few other laws that we want to point out is the civil money penalties law. It's important because that law outlines the improper conduct and provides limits, particular dollar amounts for penalties. So labs will want to make sure that they review that when they're developing their compliance program. The next one, the False Claims Act, really, this one has been the basis of all the recent activity that we've heard about. Some of the, as David said, the news. This has to do with the key TAM relators and whistleblowers, for instance. The penalties for a false claim can be really severe, up to $10,000 per false claim, and then treble damages. Most of you know about CLIA. That really has to do with that ensures the quality of laboratory operations, which you'll want to look at as part of the compliance program as well. One topic, the state laws, which I know David mentioned, really have become increasingly more important for certain additional regulations that you should be aware of. Different states have different laws, have distinctions with anti-kickback or fee-splitting statutes or direct billing laws that really you should, if you are doing business or collecting specimens from that particular state, you'll want to take a look at. The last one we'll dive into a little bit more in detail for privacy and security, but that's the Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act, which is HIPAA. All right, so now this next slide, I'm not going to go into great detail, but we've listed out the guidance issued by the OIG, and as you can see, it's extensive. These are fraud alerts and advisory opinions that are helpful to look at and reference in your compliance program and plan, so you can help identify the high-risk areas and what the government is looking at, which many of these topics will go into detail later in the presentation. So I will turn it back to David.
David, I believe your line is muted.
Sorry, my line is muted. I apologize. We just got through the appetizers, and we're now into the main course. And the good news is that we've tried to put this together, although it will be in the context of the framework of the core elements of a compliance plan. We have a special treat for you. We've invited Dana Simons to join us. Dana and I go back many, many years, but she's one of the most consistent and impressive compliance officers that I have the opportunity to work with and have had over many years in many contexts. She's got the kind of experience that I often call her seeking her guidance on particularly practical issues relating to how a compliance program should be administered. And so with that, I guess and we were thinking about putting this together, I thought, wow, wouldn't it be great to have that kind of a dialogue? And so we're going to try to facilitate that. Bear with us. But I think the idea will be to have us share some thoughts and particularly get some perspective from Dana, who has to deal with this stuff day-to-day inside the trenches, as opposed to the perspective sometimes that outside lawyers have as advisors in this area. So any suggestions you want to start with, things you can recommend right off the bat relating to the core compliance elements, Dana?
Sure. Thank you, David, for the nice compliments. Yeah, I agree. I always find it valuable to collaborate with lawyers who specialize in my space and network with peers in the industry who have experience in practical application of compliance objectives in our line of service. I think we all share the common goals of getting it right the first time, reducing risks, protecting the organization, and valuable healthcare resources. So for our discussion, I agree. I think it would be helpful to kind of follow the seven-element framework, but you'll see as we kind of go through the Q&A, the subsequent answer to some of the questions will respond to multiple elements. So let's get started.
In my role, this is Kristen speaking. In my role as counsel, I often field calls from compliance officers or other laboratory executives about starting a compliance program or modifying an existing one. Dana, if you're a startup laboratory or a laboratory that's looking to modify the compliance program, where's a good place to start?
Well, if you're a startup, you know, once you've identified your compliance officer, identified the committee team members, written a committee charter so that you have your scope and your code of conduct for your employees, I guess I would start with outlining the core components of your compliance program manual. And there are a variety of resources available from the OIG's model compliance program, Medicare manuals, previous enforcement actions like you guys have been discussing earlier, and settlements. Those are all good places to start. And then later in the presentation, I'll talk a little bit about industry resources. The next thing, though, in building your plan out, it's key to identify your risk areas, as each lab's business model may be different. So, for example, a toxicology lab may have different risks than a genetic laboratory. Once you identify your risk areas, you set out to create an annual work plan that will help you and the committee identify and prioritize key items to address for your laboratory. So I have an annual work plan, and it changes every year. I review it with the board and get it approved by the board, and then I set forth and work on those projects for the year.
Dana, you mentioned a committee. Can you talk to us a little bit about how important it is to have a compliance committee and who should be on that?
Sure. Well, it's very important. It's a core component of your program. If you've been in the industry long enough, you've heard the mantra, compliance is everyone's responsibility. I may have the title and lead the department, but in our organization, compliance is one of the defining components of our culture. During my training, I weave in our company's mission, vision, and values into the code of conduct discussion. We have a board committee and an operating committee. Because we are a business associate providing services to covered entity laboratories, my members are a little bit different, so it reflects my organization. While it depends on how your company is organized, generally speaking, your operating committee should include someone from billing, business development or sales and service, operations, pathology, IT, human resources, And depending upon your particular laboratory, perhaps patient services or phlebotomy.
Dana, another question that I often receive has to do with hiring a compliance officer. In your experience, what are some qualifications and traits labs should look for when hiring a compliance officer?
Well, to be honest with you, experience really helps here. Having worked in the lab industry for 25 years is a huge help. I joined a major laboratory shortly after they settled with the federal government and learned compliance by rolling it out under a corporate integrity agreement. So there's nothing like trial by fire and experience in the field. But if you're coming in as a compliance officer without lab experience, you're going to have a learning curve. So once you get up to speed on operations, I would suggest reading some of the history of the settlements during the lab scan in the 90s to get a feel for the types of issues that they dealt with and, quite frankly, what has shaped some of the policy mentioned later in this presentation. Another attribute is being a people person. I enjoy interacting with folks and understanding how and what they do during their day-to-day job and trying to help them solve business problems.
And I'd just like to add, because I'm also a certified compliance officer, that going and a lawyer, but I think going through the process and what we've seen, like the trend is that labs are looking for compliance officers with certification, either from the healthcare, the HCCA, the Healthcare Compliance Association, or the AAPC is the American Association of Professional Coders, but they do have a certification for compliance officers as well. And we've seen going through that actual process was helpful because it really I had to study the areas that are key to the healthcare profession. Some of the challenges that I've seen is that you can't find a compliance officer that's specifically in the laboratory industry. So as Dana said, it is a learning curve. It's if you have a basis of healthcare, you can get up to speed, but it's really getting, as we've listed, the resources related to labs. It would be good that somebody's well versed in that area.
David, I believe your line is muted.
Well, I think Kristen, one of the things that you mentioned were some resources, and Dana, I'd appreciate your perspective on some of the resources that are available. I want to mention one real quickly here, that just this week, the OIG handed out an early holiday present, I guess, called the Practical Guidance for Healthcare Governing Boards on Compliance Oversight. And it's a terrific document, one that can be used, I think, to educate yourselves, but also to help educate your boards and your management. It addresses things like we're talking about here, including statements like smaller organizations may meet their compliance responsibility by using available personnel rather than employing separate staff to carry out their compliance and ethics programs. But it talks about a range of things and a range of ideas for making your compliance plan effective. Dana, why don't you talk to us a little bit about some of these that are on the slide, but also in your experience, what's been useful?
Well, yeah, actually, I'm also certified in compliance and privacy through Healthcare Compliance Association. In fact, I left that conference to come here, so they have an annual conference. I can tell you that I find that certification to be most helpful in my job. You can join the association for a nominal fee and then kind of work your way through the process of becoming certified. My job is my profession, and the industry is growing, and once I joined HCCA and became certified, I felt like I had a huge advocate who understands my challenges and that they were in my corner. They constantly are refreshing and providing resources, tools, and information on their website. There are plenty of speakers that bring useful resources that I can take and apply to my own industry or my own organization. Some of the resources that I've listed here are the ones that I use the majority of the time. It includes vendors in not only the lab, but the compliance industry, trade associations, newsletters. Some of the newsletters are free of charge, some you pay a fee for. The lab industry report is another one that is a great, valuable newsletter that comes at a fee, but it's certainly well worth it. I've also found compliance industry product demonstrations or free webinars helpful to research current trends or offerings and pick up solutions that I need to build out a particular component of my program. It won't take you long to whittle out the vendors or associations that don't provide enough value for the precious time that you have available, but hopefully this is a good start.
The next slide addresses one of the core seven elements and of education and training. Dana, in your experience, this seems to be very, very important. Do you have any tips for educating and training employees?
Sure. I have modules. So orientation is one of my modules, and it includes the core components that are listed on this slide. In the past, I've developed department-specific modules for sales and marketing, billing, and phlebotomy. Each year, all employees receive annual refresher training where I change the theme of the presentation, and some of the content will be changed based on risk areas that I dealt with during the previous year, my hotline calls, or if we added a new line of service or something changed about our business operations, I may have to update the slides. The point is to make it reflect your organization and keep it current, add in graphics or an interesting theme, and then at the end of the training, I collect an attestation that confirms not only their attendance, but that they agree to abide by the program and report up concerns. I also ask them if they're aware of any concerns. I include a quiz, and this year I'm rolling out my annual refresher training on a computer-based program. We're a decentralized environment, so this will make it easier to train all employees within a certain time frame, track the completion, the attestation, and the quiz answers. And I found a really great computer-based training program for less than $1,500. So, you know, price point is important to me as I build out my program. What I am finding, though, is prices are coming down in the industry, and I'm finding more robust software with more pieces all rolled into one package, and that price point's coming down. So I'm excited to see some of the things that are coming available to compliance officers in the industry.
And those resources that you just mentioned, do you find out about that through the associations?
Exactly, mm-hmm. Through Healthcare Compliance Association. You can even go onto their website today and you can look at all of the vendors that support that association, and you can reach out to them, and you can get white papers, you know, case studies, get on their blogs. There's a lot of information available out there for you.
This slide addresses another one of the seven core elements in developing effective lines of communication. Dana, do you have any suggestions on this element? What does developing or maintaining effective lines of communication look like?
Well, I do. I'm typically one of the first people to get new employees in an audience. So I talk to them about the variety of ways that they can engage with me during their orientation training. We're a smaller organization, so I pretty much know everybody and receive most of my inquiries either in person or via email or through like a telephone call. But I also have a hotline service that's hosted by Navex Global that allows for not only anonymous calls, but people can report issues through an online portal as well. So they can log in, report their issue, and then receive a confidential key and then come back and check on the status of that issue. I publish posters and put those up in key places. I have wallet cards that I give out during the training. And I push out a newsletter every quarter right prior to our town hall, and then I'm on the agenda of the town hall. I have about 5 minutes where I talk about the information or the content in the newsletter. So I have a seat at the table, and I have support from the CEO and the board down. So compliance is talked about from the top down, which supports my role and the messages that I'm trying to get out. I'm also working on developing content for middle management this year to use as vignettes during their team meetings. But the most effective method is to basically talk with employees in the organization. If you're genuinely interested in what they do, you'll find opportunities to connect with them and issues will present during just a normal course of conversation.
I'm gonna interject one thought here too, folks, and it's this. In my experience, and this is both as in-house counsel and outside, the whistleblower is the person who doesn't receive an audience, who I spoke in Vegas a few years ago and talked at length about a particular settlement and was a bit disparaging of whistleblowers. And at the end of the presentation, there was somebody waiting to talk to me, and finally, it turned out that this was one of the whistleblowers in the cases I had mentioned. And she described a scenario that I think we'll all want to avoid, which is to have raised an issue to a number of layers or levels of the organization, and at each turn, she was essentially told, you know, go away. And so that's something that you can avoid by following the kinds of suggestions that Dana suggested, but also listen specifically to those people who may be the squeaky wheels, because they're the ones that are the ones who do need answers, and that's part of what you need to not discourage, but to foster. We can go ahead to the next slide.
Great. So another question that comes up quite frequently is how we've mentioned risk areas, and one question that comes up is, well, how do I identify risk areas for my particular laboratory? So I'm gonna start off with Dana and then head to David about what are some key compliance risk areas specific to the lab industry that should be included in a compliance program?
Yeah, so for the most part, all of the items listed on this page are either found in the OIG Model Compliance Guide for Labs or covered in one of the fraud alerts or advisory opinions or other industry guidance. Some of the basics, though, include requisition design, ensuring that it does not lead to ordering more than what is needed, providing disclosure on upcharges or reflexing, give physicians a choice to order less inclusive tests. If your lab system is capable of creating custom panels and pre-printing on the requisition, there are some business rules that should be established. Acknowledgments collected from the physicians prior to putting the preprints into production. Does somebody with technical or clinical background approve the creation of that profile or preprint? I can tell you that I've run into a situation where preprints had tests that were mutually exclusive in them and some of the custom profiles. So you do have to have somebody reviewing the creation of those and signing off on it. The OIG also encourages laboratories to educate physicians on how to do business with the laboratory for Medicare and Medicaid patients. So an annual notice is the perfect opportunity for doing that education and covering off on such issues as medical necessity, the rules around ABNs, frequency limits, the Medicare rates that labs receive for tests that are ordered by physicians. It's all in the OIG Models Compliance Guideline. The annual notice is also, I think, a perfect opportunity for sales and service to educate physicians and to troubleshoot issues. Let's face it, ABN compliance is typically a challenge area for most laboratories. Lacking or inappropriate documentation around add-ons, clarifying ambiguous test orders, diagnosis codes and their translation are all risk areas for labs that need clear policy or process, not to mention training. Also, looking at your test volumes on an annual basis to spot check anomalies, it is essentially what the OIG is doing in the 2015 OIG work plan, so you should be doing it first. You can look at your own organization's test volume, set up parameters for a review, and document your findings. A dramatic jump in one test year over year for a particular client may make total sense. If not, look closer to see what that driver is. Look at your charge master, profiles, your marketing activities, promotions, or campaigns. There's something underlying that will explain it. So I think David.
Yeah, sure. I just want to talk a little bit about the supplies and equipment, and I'll drop down to the interfaces. I mean, I think it's important to, we mentioned the Ameritox settlement, or not settlement, but the jury verdict, and that underscores a fairly long legacy of direction given by the OIG and CMS about the fact that supplies and equipment that are provided to physicians need to be solely related to and used solely for the ordering of lab testing and receiving of lab test results. And if they're used for other things or can be used for other things, in most cases, that's not something that's permissible. Should note, too, that this is a particular challenge for people coming into the industry from other areas. It's common for us to encounter people who are coming from a pharmaceutical background and wanting to promote testing to physicians. And there the rules have been different, largely because Stark Law wasn't something that constricted their supplying particular things to doctors. Another note here is that interfaces, again, have been the focus of quite a lot of attention because they were, a dozen years ago, the government said, go ahead and help subsidize the interfaces, or not the interfaces, but the EHRs for the doctors. And they're at the end of, not this past 2014, but the end of 2013, the government clarified that basically sunsetted that permissive guidance. And it's now the case that laboratories may not, in any circumstance, subsidize in any way the EHRs of their clients. It's also important to note that in that context, the government was careful to carve out the permissibility of a laboratory-only interface so that it's used only for the transmission and of orders and results. Chris, you want to talk about lunches? Anybody hungry?
Yeah, perfect. Yes, sure. So the non-monetary compensation, which is you providing lunches, gifts, promotional items to doctors, has come up a lot recently with, you know, the sales and marketing team in particular. Labs and, you know, providers want to make sure that they're tracking how much they're spending. There's guidance. There's an annual limit on how much non-monetary compensation you can provide to each provider. Currently, it is $392 a year. We advise the laboratory develop some sort of tracking tool. I know that there are tracking tools that exist out there, but the labs will want to make sure that this is an area where that it's audited because of additional exposure. Another high-risk area that, you know, we've seen and David mentioned previously with the case involving HDL, is consulting arrangements. That was Blue Wave Consultants. There was an issue there with kickbacks and the Stark Law. I think you want to make sure that you're complying with both federal and there are different state laws that come into play here. There's also employee versus independent contractor rules that you'll want to be aware of when you're entering into consulting arrangements. You just note the other items on this slide relating to billing and reimbursement, copays, deductibles, fee schedules, specimen processors, and phlebotomy will be addressed later in the presentation as specific areas that we go into greater detail. The next slide, which David has advanced, which is, thank you, David. So the point here and the takeaway is that we just want to make the point that not all of these risk areas may apply to your laboratory. You wanted to identify some of the ones that do come up And four, you will want, as part of your compliance program, to identify the ones that apply to you. Once you've identified those risk areas, you'll want to use the seven core elements to develop your plan, developing the policies, procedures, training, and importantly, which I don't know if we've mentioned yet, is you want to, in addition to training, you want to develop standards and rules that with regard to these risk areas with disciplinary guidelines. So if a sales and marketing person doesn't follow the rules for non-monetary compensation, you want to have a procedure or process of how you deal with that, how you address it as a corrective action program, which is the last bullet, for improper conduct. Lastly, and we'll go into greater detail, is the auditing and monitoring of personnel and how we're dealing with these issues, which is the next slide. So I just want to kick it off for, you know, David and Dana, but one of the core elements of a compliance program is the auditing and monitoring program. We've gotten a lot of calls about this of, what does this look like? How are laboratories doing this? So David, I'll turn it over to you. And what have you seen as the trends and challenges, best practices in this area?
Well, one of the things that can happen is that laboratories can and often are pressured to undertake some kinds of audits and often to engage an outside entity to come in and look things over, and that can be performed as a baseline audit. One of the challenges with that, particularly if you're just starting your compliance program, is it can be a bit of a demoralizing experience. That may have the effect, unintended, of creating a we-they or environment where some of the people who have not yet been properly trained or maybe haven't gotten all of the education and information that they need to are getting failing marks for not having met all of the standards that are outlined in the audit that you've put together. In my experience, one of the things that we came up with when I was at Unilab was the idea of a teaching audit. And that was intended, as we were getting people educated and trained, we wanted to make sure that the people in the various departments and operational areas had the opportunity not just to receive training, but the leaders of those areas were engaged to participate in what we call the teaching audit. They were went with us as we went through and audited the various areas of our compliance program. The effect of that was that we had then developed a colleague or somebody who also understood the compliance audit and who was not going to be surprised the next time that was done by an independent entity. Also gave them the ability to think about and come up with solutions to system weaknesses and training deficiencies and other things. So we found that was a very, very constructive and well-received approach to rolling out an audit as an initial audit. And we followed that up with more traditional objective audits after that initial teaching audit. Dana, what's your experience been?
Yeah, so I, that's a good point about training opportunities, uncovering training opportunities. I recently updated some policies and procedures in my organization, and because I'm decentralized, I wanted to actually connect with folks and set up an Excel spreadsheet and conducted phone surveys with about half the organization that were in a variety of sites around the country. And it was really a valuable experience. And I had somebody on the phone with me. I actually had outside counsel, and I had an employee And it was very interactive. The questions were not, you know, plenty of them were yes or no, so that I could drop them to a spreadsheet and create metrics. But I also had some open-ended questions, and we were able to really dialogue and uncover some opportunities for improvement, for process improvement. So, you know, phone interview process will certainly be used again in my organization. Walking the field, I mean, that acronym has been around forever, and in fact, at HCCA conference this week, the OIG spoke and talked about management by walking around and getting to know your folks and understanding what a day in their life is like. Process mapping is another a good tool. If you have Visio or are proficient in it, if not, you can basically draw it out by yourself by hand and then put it to PowerPoint. But basically understanding every step in a particular department or process, especially if it's complex, and breaking it down. And when you get everybody in the room and look at the process map, it's interesting how when you speak to them separately, how they understand the process to work. And then when you get everybody in the room and you look at the map and they're all looking at each other going, well, no, I thought it happened this way. No, I thought it happened that way. So that was another valuable tool, and we were able to gain alignment and streamline the process and get it back on track. So the next question is basically about sales and marketing, and I particularly like this area. I like interacting with sales and marketing people. They're on the front lines. They're always dealing with new or creative situations and need guidance, and I really value the sales leadership or the sales folks that like to engage the compliance officer and talk about what they're seeing. So I guess this question is for you, Kristen. What have you seen other laboratories doing to effectively manage their sales and marketing team?
Well, I think I'd just like to start off by, tailoring to what Dana was saying about really creating that environment where the sales and marketing team feels comfortable reaching out to the compliance earlier rather than later address the issue before it's actually a problem. So showing an interest in what I've seen effectively work for best practices is teams, compliance departments, management actually doing in-person trainings, having with labs that have large sales and marketing folks, having in-person training so they can ask the questions in person, showing an interest in how their business objectives and trying to assist while being mindful of the regulatory world, I think is very, very important. Some of the challenges are that this is a fast-paced environment, and you've got the compliance department has to balance the legal concerns with the business growth. So you want to be mindful of the timing on the business on the sales and marketing folks, but also just making sure you have an answer. As we've seen, the compliance officers will reach out to legal counsel, and we're very mindful that the timeline issue. So you'll want, as the compliance department, you'll want to make sure you have your executive team on board, so they're ready to and aware of some of the issues going on.
Yeah, I definitely don't feel alone in this area. So I work with sales and marketing people, and if anything at any point feels like it's in a gray zone, I've got outside counsel at my disposal. I've got inside counsel, outside counsel, and my executive team and board members are my partners. So I would never make a decision in a silo that I thought might have some risk associated with it.
The next high risk area is for David. Billing and reimbursement, everyone's favorite topic. David, what's your experience with in-house outside counsel in this area?
Well, I'll tell you, this has gotten a lot of attention because of the difficulties brought about by the changing landscape in terms of payment noted up there are the co-payments and deductibles and some of the challenges that relate to the fact that some of the laboratory testing is much more expensive than it used to be, higher complexity. It's become a situation where I think because of some of the news stories, and you'll note that in the middle of last year, the OIG issued a report that was titled Questionable Billing for Medicare Part B Clinical Laboratory Services. So there's some skepticism on the part of the public and the government about how well laboratories understand the rules for billing and how well they follow them. I also think it's important for folks on the phone to note that the OIG 2015 work plan, and Dana mentioned this, specifically points to the fact that the OIG intends to review Medicare payments to clinical laboratories to determine labs' compliance with selected billing requirements. We'll use the results of these reviews to identify clin labs that routinely submit improper claims. And one of the other things to note is that in at least four of the recent settlements that are part of the document we've appended to this presentation, the discovery of or the investigation itself began through OIG data mining, through OIG auditors. So the focus is on the front end and making sure that the billing that's taking place is done appropriately. You need to have the right people in place. You need to have the right systems in place to make sure that billing is being done appropriately. And then with regard to pricing and reimbursement, making sure that your practices are consistent with recent guidance given by or coming out of the OIG and some of the civil activity that's taking place. We're going to move to the next slide here. I think we need to be thoughtful there. Kristen, can you move that forward? Oh, here we go.
No, I just did.
Thank you. Privacy and security, and Kristen can talk to us about that quickly.
Sure, yeah, just being mindful of time. I think that just like the laboratory, like the increased enforcement actions that we've seen in the laboratory industry, this is an area where the Office of Civil Rights, OCR, is very active, given, as most of you have probably heard of, is all of the breaches going on. So I think this area, one thing that I want to highlight in addition to the information provided on the slides is something that actually Dana and I had a conversation about what she did to actually find out what's going on. It's really getting out in the field and learning about the system. It's a balance of the law, but also how the system is run, how IT is run. So getting IT involved, understanding the system, understanding the process of how folks are dealing with the privacy issues, I think is, while being mindful of the law, is the takeaway for this high risk area.
Yeah, I would agree. I just recently went through a privacy and security audit, and HIPAA scares some people, and you just have to dive in. I've used outside consultants and law firms. I've also found that the OCR tool was most helpful in the security risk analysis, and I sat side by side with my security officer in IT and went through the entire assessment. And it took us 2 weeks to get through it, but we documented everything. We outlined our required and addressable specifications, and it was a really good process, and you will come out of it on the other end certainly understanding the security side much, much better. And HCCA, the Healthcare Compliance Association, has a blog where I can post questions on a daily basis. If I have a security or a privacy question or a challenge, there are a lot of other people that are in my shoes, and somebody's been there, done that, and has some advice for me. But I also always can come back to outside counsel on that one to check it.
Very quickly, we'll talk briefly about some of the other trends or challenges. Right now, because of the fact that there are a number of new laboratories who are seeking to introduce their lab testing to doctors and patients across the country. The challenge is that they, in most cases, don't have existing infrastructure, draw stations, or in-office collectors. And as a consequence of that, I think we've seen the processing and handling idea come forward that resulted in the HDL settlement that was announced early in April. The fact of the matter is people need to keep in mind as they're endeavoring to figure out how to collect specimens and get them to the laboratory, they need to avoid being too creative. The New Jersey criminal case was about sham leases and payments to doctors for collections. When you're thinking about things like roving phlebotomists or putting somebody on a temporary basis, it's also very important to keep in mind that those phlebotomy and some of the other pre-analytical services under the lab laws are regulated by the states. And then some places like New York and Florida and Pennsylvania and California, there are specific restrictions on who can perform those services and whether they can do so inside a doctor's office. This is an important area for you to get good legal guidance. And we'll turn to the very last slide here. Kristen?
Great. Thanks, David. So just very, very quickly, the key takeaways here from our presentation, just to wrap up, is that there is increased activity in investigations by both federal and state governments in the laboratory sector and really in healthcare in general, as seen by the settlements, by the amount of money that the governments are putting into this. The compliance programs are essential, required by law, and really part of you'll want to implement if you want to pursue business opportunities. Creating, as Dana said, creating a core compliance team is huge to collaborate, to work through some of the issues that arise in this area, and really consult associations and other people, even if they're your competitors, have conversations with them. That's really important. Understanding some of the high-risk areas that we've discussed and listed out for you to communicate and educate and train your workforce members will help you develop your compliance program. And as I just mentioned, seeking help and guidance from the folks at the top to legal counsel to colleagues is really in your best interest. There's so many interests that you have to consider: industry demands and objectives, regulatory requirements. That it's really the takeaway here is to seek help and really get as much knowledge you can to develop your program.
We have a few questions that have come in. Thanks to both Dana and to Kristen for their help with this presentation and the very, very good information provided. I'm going to read the questions. And
let me start and remind everybody how to ask the questions.
Sure.
Ladies and gentlemen, at this time we'll conduct the question and answer session. To ask a question via the web presentation, select the chat pod located in the lower left corner of your screen. Then type and send your question that way. We're now ready to begin.
Okay, the first question we have is, what is a laboratory under the regulations? And the definition is fairly simple. It's in CLIA, and it talks about, CLIA says that a clinical laboratory is any facility that does laboratory testing on specimens from humans or derived from humans to give information for the diagnosis, prevention, treatment of disease, or impairment of, or assessment of health. I think the question was in the context of employer or an employee drug testing, and generally that is not deemed to be clinical laboratory testing under the CLIA purview. It's deemed to be forensic or otherwise. The next question we have is, and this one I'll give to Dana, do you have any recommendations for working with students in our labs, what kind of training should they receive and how should they receive it?
Well, so I don't have direct experience, but what I can say is that if I brought in a consultant or a vendor or, let's say, an intern into my organization, they would go through my compliance program. So, I mean, I hope that helps, but I haven't dealt with students directly in my role or scope.
I think one of the things that you can keep in mind here is that anybody who is going to be performing anything on your behalf or could hold him or herself out as your agent, you will have responsibility imputed to you by the law. So these people, to the extent that you have a training that you make available to your employees, if you've got people who are independent contractors who are involved in any of the activities that are high-risk areas, those are people you should either make sure that they're getting trained or by you, or make sure that the training that they are receiving, say, from their own agency or organization is appropriate for your purposes and it meets your standards, because you have and can have exposure and responsibility based on their conduct. The last question,
David,
I just want to
add one thing, and I don't have direct experience with the laboratories, but I do with students involved in with hospitals, and my prior experience of my prior law firm on the East Coast, that there are specific state laws that do govern training with students in particular facilities. So that's another consideration that you should look at for that particular state.
You also have to keep in mind that there are also some employment laws that are triggered by training, even of people who may be temporary or part-time. Generally, the rule is that they need to be paid during the training. Paid their normal wage during that time. The last question that we have here is, can a lab medical director bill for professional fees of laboratory tests such as a CBC? And the answer to that is a lawyer's favorite, which is it depends. The question here is going to be, bill whom are we billing? Medicare? If the laboratory medical director is an independent laboratory, i.e. it's a pathologist who's rendering that professional service independently in a different facility, then there might be a basis for a professional fee to be billed, again, depending on the circumstance. And otherwise, generally, the answer is no. So it really depends on how the medical director is affiliated with the laboratory. It also, the answer would change as well in the context of hospital laboratory billing, which has more specific answers and guidance. And that's the questions that I see up on the screen. Are there any others before we sign off? All right. If not, thank you all so much for your time and attention. Thanks to Dana and to Kristen and also to for the support of the webinar folks.
Yep, it was a pleasure to be here, and I certainly would welcome any questions if anybody wants to call or send an email.
Yes, thank you very much for your participation.
This concludes today's webinar. Thank you for attending.